Mr. Bright, real fast.
Well, there were people who suffered from too much water, I suppose, in the blood, and their legs would swell up during the day, something phenomenal, like elephantiasis. And at night, they'd be up all night, getting rid of this water. It is a medical condition, but quite a lot suffer from them. And strange enough, they would be excused work, but they just couldn't walk. Their legs were like tree trunks. And it is really a heart condition. But I was all right from that point of view, although soon after liberation, I had pleurisy and a little bit of TB in one corner of the lungs. So I wouldn't have lasted that much longer. Anyway, the Russians came, they didn't really care. They didn't give us any assistance whatever. Whether we didn't fit into their political outlook as we then political prisoners, I'm not sure. But the fact is, it wasn't very helpful. I had these clogs, and I was desperate to change into shoes. But I, as always, I'm a bit slow. I was walking around, ever so happy that we were liberated, when others began to look for things who were more vivid. And I was rather late. And in the end, I went into a shoe repair shop. Well, of course, the shoes in the shoe repair shop, they're there because there's something wrong with them. So I got a pair of jack boots because there was a nail in them. So I wasn't very comfortable walking. So I had a bit of a problem. I can't remember what I did in the end, but I managed to get the nail out or get another pair. I also managed to acquire a bicycle. There were quite a lot of them around. And I couldn't ride a bicycle. I had to learn it there. Now, the problem with the bicycle is it's easy enough to learn to ride, but I didn't have the strength to pedal. So after a week or so, maybe 10 days there, we decided we would try to get home. This pal I joined up with, he was going back to Poland or to the nearby women's camps to see whether his mother was still alive. He was sure she was. He was a poor devil. He had TB in his heel, and it was oozing all the time. So he was in a bad state. So he left, and I left on this bicycle, some direction to take. And before long, I found myself on the Czech border, and they laid on the train for me. There may have been one or two others. I don't think so, but anyway, they laid on the train for me, and I got to Prague. And in Prague, the first thing I did was look whether anybody had reappeared at our flat. Of course, nobody had. The concierge said that the day after we left, a van had drawn up and emptied it of all the possessions that were well organized. So that was it. I stayed at the YMCA, which again, Prague being the hub of a railway system and undamaged. None of the Czech part had been bombed. Refugees tended to flock to Prague. So I had a room at the YMCA. I had to again get a bit of this eating. I then went to a school. Before the schools opened, they put beds in metal beds, and we stayed in classrooms. We had to be given a little bit of money. I was given a pretty awful suit made from German material, which obviously can keep its shape. So what to do next? Do you want to know what I did next?
Yes. Well, how you came to Britain in particular?
Yes, right. Well, that was some time to go. I went to an organization, a sort of a youth organization. I said, what can you do for me? What can I do for you? And they didn't know. They have a very bureaucratic state of mind. That's a survival of the Austrian Empire. And I said, you're an orphan? You're going to an orphanage. No, I didn't want to go to an orphanage because my background to ordinary orphans was so different. I wouldn't have fitted in. I wanted to be one myself, all these people of like experience. And then I said, well, the Sudeten are being emptied of Germans. We've got to fill it. Would you like to go to the Sudeten? And they said there is a factory. The Germans built with POW labour, as it transpired later, I think, of British POW labour. It was a factory making anti-aircraft sights, sort of distance meters. They were mechanical. They didn't have radar. They were mechanical. They were rangefinders. And they consisted of a long tube with a mirror and a split image. And if you saw an aircraft and if you could manage to get this image, just split image straight, you could read off the distance and you would set your fuses according to the height. They left that, and we want to start making cameras. It's all there. There's one part is for glass, for grinding glass. The other one's for the metal parts. Would you like to become an apprentice? And I said, yes, I need an alternative. Oh, I couldn't see my way. I mean, there may have been 300 other alternatives, but I didn't know what to do, and I had worked in metals, and I thought being a tool maker, which is what it was a good thing. All right, I tried that, and off I got it. It wasn't very good. The factory was excellent. The factory had been built to the design of Zeiss of Jena, who to this day makes the cameras and lenses. Every apprentice in a huge apprentice hall had a bench and a small lathe, and we worked from blueprints which were not connected with production at all. We were just increasing our skill from simple things to more difficult, learning to file, to grind, to turn, to heat treat, doing things like that. And they were very difficult bits to do. The first thing you did was a 1 centimeter cube, which is terribly difficult by hand, because it all has to be at right angles in every dimension. So if you took too much off one side, you had to start again. It wasn't easy to be polished in the end. Anyway, I did that. But of course, all the other apprentices were from Prague. They had their parents in Prague. They would go home over the weekend, have their clothes washed and be filled up with food and come back. Well, I didn't have the facility. And it was much harder for me. And neither had we anything in common. Obviously, I experienced a concentration camp. They hadn't. It wasn't terribly good. So I left that hostel and moved to what I can only call a Jewish hostel. There were many people from the Podkarpatian Ukraine, which was the narrow bit of the Republic, which had been ceded to Russia. Well, they didn't want to go to Russia. They just didn't want them. They wanted to get out. And they would either go to Palestine or America. Well, they did have relatives in the States. And so there are quite a lot of them there in that town. They did all sorts of things. One was a dental technician apprentice. I had a girlfriend who was a seamstress. People kept themselves until such time as they could get out. And that was much better. Again, we had no food, we had no money. We were supposed to hand over what we earned, but as an apprentice, you don't get an awful lot. And there was no recognition of the special needs of people who did not have parents. You know, we just had no money. It was very difficult. I know the Jewish relief organization sent us once 1 tin of spam or corned beef or something. That was all we ever had. It was very difficult. But then the question arose, where would we want to go from there? Well, some people had no hesitation. They wanted to go to America, and other people wanted to go to Palestine. And we had a member of the Jewish Brigade, which had been formed in Palestine, that fought in the war, come to see us from Vienna. And I remember asking him, well, if I go to a kibbutz, and kibbutz was the only thing I knew, living in towns didn't occur, and you wouldn't, but you could only live in a kibbutz because you had no means of support. A kibbutz gives you mutual support. You know, you would work for a community that would support you, support them. And there was most people did that in those days, not anymore, of course. And I said, well, what can I do? What will happen? Will they send me to the Technion? Can I get some technical education if I want to be a mechanic or something? Well, he said, quite truly, it was honestly, he said, well, they'd put a pin on the kibbutz. So I didn't quite know what was going to happen. And also, of course, you couldn't go there straight. You had to hide away in ships and travels past Greece and Yugoslavia and try to board there. Now then, these distant relatives, they found me through the Red Cross. I had registered with them, like everybody else had, and these lists were published, and they saw me, and they, and through a relative of theirs who had money, they didn't, they asked me, did I want to come to England? Well, England seemed much more safe as a future than Palestine in those days. And so I said yes. But that was not the end of the matter. To start with, they had to deposit £500 with the Home Office so that I wouldn't be a burden on the public purse. I was allowed to enter, but not to work, to accept work, either paid or unpaid, for at least 6 months. That was the condition of entry. They had to process my visa, and nothing happened. It was with the British Embassy in Prague, and absolutely nothing happened. I was really, really concerned. I had a relative who had come back from the army. He had been in the Czech part of the British army, and I'd never met him before. Again, he found me. The same name, Brister. He's an Australian now, and his father who died. He went to the embassy, and they said, oh, you know, it will be processed in due course. And the woman who looked after us at the hostel, she was a bit of a clairvoyant. I have come across clairvoyants before, and they were usually quite good. And she said, if you worry, it will take longer. If you can only relax, it's at the bottom of a pile. And if you don't think about it, you'll be all right. It was very difficult, and it's quite true. It was on the bottom of the pile. And it had never been processed, or took months to process. And in the end, I was granted this visa, and I had a Czech passport. Now, that wasn't easier. It was being born in Berlin, I had to prove that I had Czech citizenship. I did prove that. I was given, but again, I had a guardian being underage. And the guardian said, no, you must come back. You can go on a visit, but you must come back. So I said, oh, yeah, sure, I'll come back. And so I was allowed to go. Now, the question was how to go. Well, trains were pretty difficult then. So I was, these relatives got me a flight ticket. And I left from Prague Airport with United Nations personnel, Czechs who were being sent to the United Nations in was Chicago at the time, or San Francisco. It was a Junkers 52, one of those three propeller airplanes, one in the middle. And it had been kitted out for paratroopers. There were just seats along the side. And it hadn't been that much of a range. It had to land at Frankfurt and Brussels, which were military airfields then, with a corrugated whole steel runways. In the end, I arrived in Hendon. Probably Hendon, I can't remember. It may have been Croydon.
When would this have been about?
It would have been in May 1946. A passenger gave me instructions. You get out here, you turn to the left, you take a tube to St. John's Wood. They lived in St. John's Wood. I had a case, and I got myself as far as St. John's Wood, and there I was. I didn't know where the turn right left was sent. I started to walk. Well, that was no good, because strangely enough, place names, street names in England are only at either end of it and not in the middle. the locals may not need them, but it's very, very difficult. So I didn't know what to do. I had hardly any money. Some money had been sent to me, £5 worth or less, probably. In the end, I got pretty desperate. I hailed a taxi, and it was just around the corner. And that was my entrance into into Britain. I couldn't work. As I say, I wasn't allowed to work, which was a shame because I already wasted so many years to spend another six months not doing anything. It seemed a bit of a waste of time, but I made good use of it. I learned English, and I started to attend evening classes. I enrolled at the Regent Street Polytechnic, and I started on an ordinary national certificate in mechanical engineering. And then I looked for a job, and a relative of mine, an uncle who lived in the same house, took me around. And it wasn't easy to get a job, because people were beginning to be demobbed, and industry hadn't got going again. Industry didn't get going until rearmament, really, until plastics came in and rearmament started. There was a surplus of people, and it wasn't easy. To be quite honest, they asked me, what did I want to do? Well, I said, I'd spent so many years just working in whatever fashion, however primitively, with metal, I better carry on so as not to waste any more time. Well, so I started in a small workshop in a mews in Camden Town, Kentish Town, really, opposite the Temperance Hospital. The boss there, Franz Schneider, had been an Austrian who came to England before the First World War. He worked for Bosch in England. Right when Carl started. And then he set up his own little business. It was quite a small shop, a very good shop, but very primitive. He had overhead shafts with pulleys and leather belts. And that's where I started. Now, the problem was that I couldn't afford an apprenticeship. An apprenticeship didn't get paid anything. On the other hand, you couldn't join a trade union unless you had an apprenticeship. You had to serve for 5 years. So I could never really become a proper tool maker in a union shop. And what I had to do was be an improver. An improver got a little bit paid. I started with 1 and 9 pence halfpenny when a charwoman would get 2 and 6. Now, 2 and 6, half a crown, which is 30p, wasn't very much. Although, of course, it's much more than this than it would be today. But relatively speaking, I got less than a charwoman. Admittedly, I wasn't all that much use, although I picked it up quickly. And because I knew trigonometry, I was the only one, apart from boss, who worked on the jig bore. The jig bore is a high-precision machine in a little cubicle of its own. It's a Swiss machine. Where you would dig holes, drill holes in the right place, very, very accurately. We made progression tools, and it was absolutely essential that all holes would line up on this tool. And I did that. I got paid a little bit extra because I could do that. And I did that for 3 years, and I just couldn't afford being there. In the end, I got 2 shillings or half a crown or something, and I just couldn't afford it. I lived very, very frugally. Evening classes didn't cost much in those days. I never went anywhere. For 7 years, I didn't have a holiday. Whatever leave I had later, I didn't have any leave in the shop. I spent preparing for the exam, and as yet I couldn't afford it. So I left for another job. I think from 2 shillings, I jumped to 2 and 6. But it was an awful shop. It was in Wilson. And then a strange thing occurred. I wanted to go in a drawing office, and my only hope was a drawing office. And I tried, and I went along Victoria Street one day. That's where all the consultants were in those days. All the names in structural and civil engineering consultancy, or mechanical. I was really mechanical up to a point. I'll come to that in a minute. They are located there, like Harley Street is for doctors. And I typed. I got a typewriter there that's in a corner. I typed 60 letters. It took 60 or more names down on a Sunday. I typed 60 applications. I sent them off, and I had no reply. People just didn't want to know. My experience in a tool room, which I would have thought would have been useful, I knew something about materials, didn't count. So that was no good. So I started a correspondence course. The correspondence course was no good because they dished out old drawings. Like steam engine valves. Well, steam engines are definitely on the way out. There's no good learning about that. Now, in the evening class, we formed into groups and we did our experiments in the basement of the Regency Polytechnic. And one of my group was a boy called Ron Warren. And he said to me one day, my parents live in Cambridge. why don't you come visit me over the weekend? It was a very nice gesture. Presumably he'd mentioned it to his parents, that he'd met this refugee, his English wasn't very good, and they said, well, why don't you take him along? And so I met these Warrens, extremely nice people, and he was a civil servant working for the Ministry of Pensions. He must have been an auditor. He went around the country and audited the books or looked at them. And in Glasgow, he found an advertisement in the Glasgow Herald that the Ministry of Works in London wanted technicians, assistants, draftsmen, assistant engineers. He sent me that, and I replied. Heard nothing for 5 weeks, I think, and then had a letter saying, would I attend for an interview? So I did, of course, and it was just before an exam that I had swatted up, and there was the assistant chief engineer and one or two other people, and they interviewed me, and they asked me specific questions. In this particular case, what's the shear diagram on a simply supported beam with two concentric loads? And I knew the answer. Maybe there's no shear in the middle between these loads. But they were very impressed. They actually offered me a grade higher than they'd advertised for. I became a junior assistant. And
which year is this?
That was in 1950. And I started, it took 3 weeks before anything happened, but after 3 weeks I had the offer, I accepted it, and I started in May in the maintenance section of the structural engineering department of the Ministry of Works. And I stayed here for three years. Now, this took me all around ancient monuments. We looked after ancient monuments, which was anything from the Imperial War Museum to the Greenwich Naval College to the Horse Guards, the Tower of London, you name it, I've been there. And yes, as a matter of fact, at that time the Victoria Tower, which is the tower opposite Big Ben, was being renovated. The tugs which had plied their trade along the Thames had been belching sulfurous fumes. Those fumes had eaten into the sandstone, and they had the scaffolding all the way up. They had it since, and also the House of Lords had been bombed, and one of the stays, the cast iron or cast steel stays of the main flagpost in the middle. There are four corners, four little flagposts in each corner, and one in the middle. They had. That had a crack that had to be repaired. And they took me up there, and I got a picture of myself right up top there, you look down on the bridges. And I'll show you that later. And so I saw that too. And one of my jobs also was the refurbishment of the House of Lords. That was very interesting because they had very interesting cast steel columns and beams, which they had been cast, and cast steel industry was highly sophisticated until it gave way to mild steel, to lowered mild steel. The beams had a sloping side at the bottom flange, which would receive arches. So you had a brick arch in between each beam, and that the lot would then be filled with a stone and a floor put on top. And it was my job to design that, and I analyzed the existing beams. It was a very interesting job. And I stayed there for 3 years, and the reason was that that if you want to become a member of the Institution of Civil Engineers, and I had done drawing office work, I needed 1 year on site, just like people who started with a contract on site needed 1 year in the drawing office to give you a rounded experience. And I asked, could I be sent on site? And they had quite a number. They were building embassies abroad, GPO buildings, GPO repeater stations that would get signals, repeaters rather old fashioned now, that was the thing then, and all sorts of things. But they said, and I had been naturalized. I had been naturalized as soon as I could. I had been naturalized about 5 years after arrival, which was 1956-51. So in 1953, I was certainly eligible. But I was told at the after a reasonable period of time, Now, I knew enough about officialese and secret service speak to know that might be never. So I said, well, that's a good thing to me, because I couldn't get on. And I left. Now, whether I did the right thing, I don't know, but I left and joined a private firm by mistake. there is a Danish firm, I can't remember their name now, and they had advertised, and I called on them, very near the offices of the Minister of Works. And they thought I'd replied to their advert, but I hadn't, I just called in off chance. And that was an oil berth in Australia, they were designing and constructing. And it was pretty boring, because you repeated the same thing over and over again, and that wasn't any good. And so I left and I joined a firm called Norman and Dorbarn, where I met my wife, who were architects and engineers. They did their own engineering. And I stayed there for not too long.
Could I just ask you a general question about whether you suffered any discrimination in Britain?
Well, that would have been the discrimination, because I was a foreigner. I wasn't sent on site. And that cost me a part of the future, because to do it on my own was very difficult. I eventually joined Sir Robert McAlpine on a site, but got paid a pittance, because they knew I had to have it. And although their men got something like £60 a week, In 1955, I got £9.10. Again, I just got married and I couldn't live on that, and that's why we emigrated. It was a pity that I was more pro-British than the Indians they were employed. I mean, I don't have any Indians there then, but there was one in our section who came from the northwest frontier. A very dark fellow, he was a local prince, and he used to shoot elephants and things like that. And he was anti-British, like Indians were, because they wanted to gain independence. They had gained independence, but they still weren't very keen on Britain. And whereas I was, and he would be sent on site without any question, because he had been part of the empire, and I wasn't. And that annoyed me a bit. Well, it annoyed me. I mean, I just took it. That was it. If they didn't, I didn't. I went somewhere else. But going somewhere else was very difficult. Because, again, it was very difficult to get a job on site.
Had you ever been tempted to return to Czechoslovakia?
No, never. There's no point in that. I don't know anybody. I wouldn't want to be there.
Because of the communist takeover?
No, because of the people. When I returned, it must have been the end of May 1945, the first shop I went into, I had to buy sunglasses. I suffered from hay fever. And the first thing I was told by the assistant was too many of us had come back. It was quite visible what I was, because I still had this haircut. That made me go eventually either one way or the other. That was pretty awful. Because, strictly speaking, very few survived. The only people who did survive were those of mixed marriages, because they had not been exposed to deportation from Theresienstadt until the very end. They had received food parcels from their mothers, and they were fit. Therefore, they survived. That poor Kling, the violinist, survived. And quite the actual proper.